So on January 1st of every year, I vow the same thing. I'm not going to make any resolutions. And every year, I break that vow. I have a laundry list of things that I want to change and do. And some of them I'm still doing. Some of them I let go of by January 2nd. But there is something powerfully compelling, isn't there, about a fresh start that we human beings find irresistible. As at least all of those who show up at my gym in January, hogging the treadmills and dragging their New Year's resolutions around the gym like a sweaty towel. Now, it is 10 days into the new year. And as I said, maybe some of us have already let go of our high resolve. But this month, this time of year, tends to highlight these dueling impulses in us. The desire for change and our resistance to change. While at the gym or grumbling and whining as I put on my running shoes, I often think of this quote from an unlikely source, particularly for Unitarian Universalists, from the Apostle Paul, who once famously lamented, "I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do." He was talking about his tendency to sin. And I know I'm not going to get very far in a sermon in a UU church if I talk about sin. But maybe I could get away with saying, yeah, we're not all sinners, but we are, to some extent, all slackers, right? One way or another. So what... You know, what is that about? What is that about? Why do we wind up doing things that we know aren't good for us and not doing the things that we know we should do that are good for us? Making resolutions, whether at New Year's or at other times, usually involves confronting our resistance to change. And it is no accident that some of the exercise routines waiting for us at that gym, that the membership that we bought in the new year, is known as resistance training. We not only push and pull against weights when we try to get our bodies in shape, but I think we also push and pull against spiritual entropy as well. Now, entropy, of course, is a word from physics that describes the tendency of things to deteriorate towards disorder and chaos unless maintained or sustained. Anyone who does home repair understands how this metaphor of entropy applies to the things that we own, the objects around us, but it also applies to everything we know and love, our beloveds, our work, our commitments all tend towards disorder, deterioration, or even chaos, and require our regular, consistent attention. There's another principle in physics that applies to our lives, and that is Newton's first law of motion, which simply states that an object that is at rest will stay at rest until an external force acts upon it. And that an object that's in motion will, of course, not change its velocity until an external force acts upon that. Applying this metaphor to our lives, we recognize that each one of us has a predilection to stay put with life circumstances that are working well or well enough, rather than take the risk of change. And so often it is those dreaded external forces that bring about the changes that we didn't want, we didn't ask for. It's the relationship breakup that you didn't initiate. It's the unexpected pregnancy. It's the fall that means you can't live independently anymore. It's the health crisis. Part of what we do in church and in fellowship life is to stretch ourselves, to grow along spiritual lives. And one of the ways we do that is we create our own external forces that can give your life a push. Maybe it's a push from behind to encourage you to growth. Or maybe it's a push from the side, sending you off into a new direction, building muscles that you did not know you had. But it takes courage. It takes courage to go up against that spiritual entropy that sort of slows us down like weight in our clothes. It takes courage to take stock of your life, and in some cases, to begin again and to resist your own resistance. I've been thinking a lot recently about this theme of change and resistance, not only because it is the theme that Soul Matters has presented that your journey groups are engaging with, but because of what's been happening in your life as a fellowship and in my life. So I want to get personal for just a minute. I want to thank you for engaging with the transitions team and the board to offer me a second year as your transitional minister. I think it sort of feels like a relief, doesn't it, for both of us, at least, that we both now know we have some additional time together to work through the transitional tasks, which are grieving, letting go, forming a new identity, and preparing for a future that won't include each other except through memory and history and affection. So there's been kind of a sweet symmetry in how this year has unfolded for all of us, for me and for you, as we are both in transition. My own resistance was to Reverend Wayne Arneson, my colleague and husband, his decision to decide to retire from full-time ministry by June of this year. And that decision meant that our co-ministry at West Shore had to end, and that I would leave a congregation that I have known and loved since 1992 when I was their student minister, their intern minister. I was not ready for this change, but I respect his clarity and his need for a different pace of life. When your former senior minister, Roger Birchhausen, announced his departure, I know there was among many grief and a feeling of loss and disruption to the rhythms and the familiarity that you had built together over 25 years. None of us, you with Roger, me with Wayne, were particularly welcoming of this change in our lives at this time. I mean, my feeling was, why mess with a good thing? But truth of the matter is, we don't get to pick the changes that come to us. We only get to decide how we are going to respond to them. We can push against the resistance. We can be challenged by it, just as we push and pull on machines to strengthen our muscles. And the good news about resistance training is that even though it might make us sore at first, we can, over time, see ourselves as being able to handle more, to be able to press more weight, to be able to run more miles, which at the beginning would seem impossible. So throughout the course of our time together, we can make the most of the time we have by taking on the issues needed to prepare you for your next chapter of life. And at the same time, I'll be exploring whether or not large church interim ministry is my next calling. To be honest, I don't anticipate a lot of heavy lifting in the next 18 months. There is so much health here in this fellowship. But, we're going to be working out together, maybe certainly putting down the weights too, and just having some fun as well. So again, when I think back on the idea of resistance training, I reflect on sometimes in my own resistance training, I have sought out mentors whether that's the coach in the gym who encourages me and corrects my form, or mentors in Unitarian Universalism. And in the earliest stages of my determination to be who I wanted to be, whether that was a physically fit person or a competent minister, I looked at the people who were my mentors, those people who were my mentors, as people who had mastered difficult circumstances, who had faced difficult transitions in their lives, had mastered them completely, had it all figured out, and I aspired to be like that. Well, this was true for me until I began to read more closely the stories of our Unitarian Universalist history and learned more about some of these great ministers that shaped our movement, led exemplary lives, ministers that I thought could do no wrong. Connie's going to tell you a story now from our history, from our Unitarian history, a story that has had a big impact on me and one that I thought about as we reflect on this question of what does it mean to be a people of resistance?
The next reading is from a book about the 19th century Unitarian minister William Ellery Channing, entitled Channing, the Reluctant Radical by Jack Mendelsohn. The abolitionist movement of the 1830s had begun to reach a fevered pitch, with many Unitarian ministers publicly denouncing slavery. Channing, however, has been reluctant to engage in the fray. In fact, he has not spoken out publicly against the abolition of slavery and was dismissive of the harshness of abolitionist language used by the younger activists. The scene is set in Dr. Channing's study between Channing and his activist protege, the Reverend Samuel J. May. One autumn day, while May was listening to Channing's routine carping about the harshness of abolitionist language, his patience snapped. Dr. Channing, he said, quite forgetting his usual reverence for the great one, I am tired of these complaints. It is not our fault that those who might have pleaded for the enslaved so much more eloquently, both with the pen and with the living voice, than we can, have been silent. We are not to blame, sir, that you, who perhaps more than any other man, might have so raised the voice of a remonstrance that it should be heard throughout the length and breadth of the land. We are not to blame, sir, that you have not spoken. And now, because inferior men have begun to speak and act against what you yourself to be acknowledged to be an awful injustice, it is not becoming in you to complain of us because we do it in an inferior style. Why, sir, have you not moved? Why have you not spoken before? The space between the two men became a void of silence. Channing's usual serene face was taut and tight-lipped. Then all at once it relaxed. In quiet, kindly tones, he said, Brother May, I acknowledge the justice of your reproof. I have been silent too long.
Channing was one of my big heroes when I entered seminary. He still is. He was slight of frame, delicate of health, but his enormous intellect helped to frame a new vision of Unitarianism and Unitarian Christianity that still has an influence on Unitarian Universalism today. His sermons, are you ready for this? 2 hours long, were said to be spellbinding. People came from all over the county when Dr. William Ellery Channing spoke. The respect for his intellect was so highly regarded. Yet, as the 19th century abolitionist movement was heating up in New England, Reverend Channing was curiously silent. Was it because he had no opinion, or worse yet, because he somehow agreed that slavery was an economic juggernaut that had no hope of being dismantled? Not true. Channing was deeply aggrieved by slavery, and he struggled with this issue. It made him physically ill, debilitating him for days at a time. Yet time and time again, he resisted using the power of his pulpit to denounce it, and he resisted the force of his pen to excoriate it in print. Why? Well, the reason it took a long time for Channing to enter this anti-slavery movement was because he was suspicious of the zealotry expressed on both sides of the issue. Those who supported slavery and those who denounced it. He despised self-righteous posturing of any kind, believing that it did not appeal to the better angels of human nature. And he wanted nothing to do with the internecine mudslinging and name-calling. But it wasn't until this confrontation with his protege, Samuel May, that Channing picked up his pen and stood behind his pulpit to lend his voice to the anti-abolitionist movement. It was this resistance to engaging with the abolitionist orthodoxy of his time that earned him the title of Jack Mendelsohn's book, The Reluctant Radical. So when we consider resistance movements in history, whether French resistance, World War II, South African resistance and apartheid, resistance fighters to the Assad regime in today's Syria, we tend to think of these as bold acts of physical courage. But what we don't consider sometimes is about the resistance that's found in the human heart that precedes taking up these public fights. This warring duality, in this case, between wanting to save the world and simply savor it, perhaps, without so much struggle. I had to tell you Channing's story because, in part, it's my story, too. When 12-year-old Tamir Rice was killed last November in Cleveland, members of the congregation I also serve, West Shore, attended a rally and a march protesting police violence. I went, but when members of the crowd, not members of the church, but members of the larger crowd, started shouting hateful and incendiary chants against the police, I wanted to leave, to distance myself from those who are using that kind of language. When I pick up the phone at the church and another anonymous caller wants to rant about why we hang a Black Lives Matter banner above the church, I want to lecture him, not listen. I want to hang up, not hang on, to see if some light can be shed amidst all that heat. And when members of West Shore in Cleveland take a Saturday morning, they've been doing this for 4, 5, 6 weeks now, to go door to door in a mostly white neighborhood, inviting people to put a Black Lives Matter sign on their front lawn, I have to look at my own resistance, my own reluctance to say yes, to put my body alongside theirs, to give up the privilege of having a safe and comfortable and non-confrontational Saturday morning. I tell you this story because their powerful commitment has made me examine my own resistance more closely. And I can only echo the words and the questions posed by today's worship leader, Connie Roop, when she asks us, have I taken a path of least resistance as discouraging events and trends unfold? How can I resist these changes? But Connie's next sentence made me laugh out loud when I first read it, because she says, and what lessons can microbes offer us? I laughed because I never thought of it in that way. And she reminded us that even the most virulent and dangerous microbe can be overcome with the proper antidote, and it will also adapt to new information by developing greater resistance. So this is kind of a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because that's a bad trait when you have a stubborn infection. But it's helpful when trying to develop new strategies for combating both personal and societal resistance to change, to positive change. What I think is important about living together in religious community, as Connie noted in her reflection, is that it is as a community where we encounter and confess our own and others' resistance to taking on difficult public policies, challenges, and also when we are able to lovingly challenge one another. And when we do that, we are made stronger. Doing resistance training together makes us more capable of looking inside ourselves and seeing what's stopping us from taking on hard things. I mean, you may be able to sit down on a resistance machine and bench press 200 pounds, and I can barely do 20, but watching you do something hard that I can't yet do inspires me to want to do something instead of nothing. I mean, not all of us are marchers or chanters or even canvassers for justice, but because of what we hear and what happens in this fellowship, because of the opportunities it gives us to push ourselves into something that may scare us a little, that experience strengthens us for the hard work of living, of loving, and of justice seeking. When Connie and I started working on this sermon together, this service together, I had no idea where it was going to go. And admittedly, if I'm out there listening to this, I'd say, okay, so we've gone from treadmills to microbes to the 19th century to public protests. It's been a bit of a wild ride. But you know, I think the theme for the month, what does it mean to be a people of resistance, is what makes it a wild ride. You can go at it from completely opposite angles, kind of like one of those resistance training machines where you get to set and reset it in different configurations to push completely different sets of muscles, different body parts, all on the same machine. So your response to the sermon is kind of like that, a reset of the weights, a pushing and pulling on the theme from a slightly different direction. And after a moment of silence, we'll have time for maybe one or two comments before we close.